Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It's Tuesday, and once again, it's time to dig in a little bit of football history with our friend, historian Timothy Brown of the footballarchaeology.com website. Today, we're going to talk about some of the football's markings and the stripes on the ball themselves. Coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we're going to stare down that portal today and go back into some of the balls themselves on the gridiron. And we have our friend from football archaeology, Timothy Brown, the great author and historian. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren. Thanks for having me back. And hopefully you and the listeners are enjoying the process. I certainly am.
Yeah, this is a blast. And folks, it's even more fun when you can get the daily tidbits, you know, delivered to your email or checking on social media. And Tim, if you don't mind, we'll do it again at the end, but why don't you give your social media and your website so people can enjoy this?
Yeah, so my website is footballarchaeology.com. So real straightforward name, and it's a Substack platforms. So it's very easy. You just subscribe, provide your email, subscribe to it. And so each day you'll get a daily tidbit or today's tidbit. And then, you know, 2 to 3 times a week, you'll get an additional email with either a full article, a link to this podcast, or, you know, some other kind of information, you know, that's football history related. So I also post on Twitter under the, you know, name Football Archaeology. And at FOFS.
And we'll have those in the show notes, folks. We'll also mention it at the end of this episode right now. And, you know, football archaeology is the perfect name, Tim, you chose, because you are sort of the Indiana Jones of the gridiron history. You really dig into the dirt, and you know, we're expecting you to find, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and everything else going on, maybe Lombardi's sweat socks or something. But so we have you know, got some interesting things, as you do every week, as you do every day, that you share with us every week here on the podcast. Now, today we're going to talk a little bit about the footballs in a recent post you had and some of the striping on the footballs.
Yeah. So, you know, this is just one of those things that, you know, I spend time looking through old college yearbooks and, you know, just looking for images that say something about the game and how it differed from today. And so in the course of doing that in the past, I've come across just changes, several different changes to the ball itself. And so, of course, you know, so I'm going to go way back first before talking about the stripes, but, you know, football started as rugby. And so initially we used the rugby ball. So it was, you know, much more of an egg shape or ovoid or oval, you know, so, but basically it was a lot fatter. And it went through a couple different stages of slimming down. And by 1934, it basically got to the more or less the shape that we have today. And so that shape was pointier, and so it was easier to throw. It was easier for somebody with a smaller hand to throw. But by becoming pointier, it also, by and large, eliminated the drop kick from the game. You know, the ball just bounced more unpredictably because of the pointier nose. And so, but besides, so that, you know, clearly there were changes in the football just in terms of the shape and its size, but then the way it was actually kind of decorated, if you will, as early as 1903 and possibly earlier, but by 1903, Amos Alonzo Stagg was painting the ball white when they were using it at night. So Chicago is a pretty tough school. Guys were in class till late. And so he had to practice late. So he installed lights fairly early on and used a white football for practice. And then, you know, typically when people were played early night games, they used either a white or a yellow painted ball. And that was kind of the case until the 1930s. And the 30s is when striping first came to be, at least as far as I can, you know, I've been able to determine. And the actually the first game that I know was striped was a 1936 BYU and then what's now Northern Colorado. And but that wasn't because of night game. It was because they were kind of arguing over whether they should use a white ball when one of the team, when BYU is going to wear white jerseys and Northern Colorado was going to wear brown pants. So they didn't want to wear, use a brown ball. So they agreed on a brown ball with white stripes. And because otherwise, you know, they were concerned about hidden ball tricks and those kinds of things.
Right.
Something we just don't, you know, don't really think about anymore. And then, you know, kind of, I don't know that the striped ball really got used a whole lot until then in the early 50s. As more and more teams were playing night games, they just weren't, you know, it was just typically they were using this white ball or a white ball with black stripes. And in other cases, they used a brown ball with either one or two white stripes. So, you know, so it was just like anything else. Football had to go through this kind of testing out or trying out period. You know, I mean, we all know where the stripes belong in a football now, but they had to kind of figure that out for a while. So early on, some of the manufacturers put the stripes further towards the middle of the ball. So they actually overlapped the ends of the laces. Now they're further out beyond the laces. And the ball also went, so, and some of them had two sets of stripes on each side. So there'd be the one that overlapped the race, the laces, and then the other one more or less where our laces or our the stripes go today. So then we got, then they got into a thing, you know, the high school association kind of required the striped ball starting in 1953. The NFL used a white ball for night games until 1956. And then they went with a tan, you know, tan or brown ball with white stripes before finally eliminating that in 1976. So since 76, they've gone with, you know, no stripes. And the NCAA, even though people were using the striped ball, they officially sanctioned it in 65 and then formally adopted the striped ball in, if I said 75, I meant 65, and then formally adopted it in 75. So it's just, you know, and then the, well, the other thing is that whether people realize it or not, the ball originally had the white stripes or the black stripes, you know, it was the full circumference of the ball, right? And then quarterbacks complained that the paint was slippery on their thumb. And so they basically, the NFL for a while took the stripe off of one of the four panels of a football. So wherever that quarterback's thumb, you know, would have been, so a right-handed quarterback, it would have been, you know, the bottom of the side of one side. If it's a left-handed quarterback, they had to have another set of another ball there or set of balls because their thumb is, you know, is on a different side of the ball. And so then when the NFL, or I'm sorry, when the NCAA moved to the white stripe as this is now a requirement, they put the white stripe only on the top panel, two panels of the ball. So
the sides that the laces are on.
That is correct. That is correct. Okay. Now the CFL has stripes on all four panels. So apparently the, I always like to say that the Canadian thumbs aren't as slippery as has American thumbs, even though most of the quarterbacks up there are Americans anyways.
Right.
So it's sort of one of those goofy little combinations of, you know, different levels of football have chosen different ways to either incorporate stripes or not. You know, and it took a little while for each of them to kind of figure out how they wanted to do it.
That's pretty neat stuff. That's pretty good history. And I know, just to take it to a modern twist, it's probably just all aesthetics, but I saw the USFL this year, their stripes were just a series of stars going around the circumference of the ball on each end where the normal stripes would be.
I thought that was kind of interesting. No, I did not pick up on that. I didn't.
It's kind of different just to be their own ball, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to turn around here. I've got an arena league ball, you know, up on the shelf behind me, but that did not have any stripes, at least at the time that it bounced into the stands to me and my sons.
I was talking to a childhood friend of mine. He ended up kicking for Pitt and played on some NFL team, Sean Conley. And in a recent interview we had with him, he was talking about where the sweet spot is for a kicker. And it's basically a nickel size, I believe he identified it as, and it's sort of right in that area where the stripe is. And he said, you know, he didn't kick in high school, but he kicked the high school ball. He was a soccer player. That's how he, you know, got his practice into want to try out, you know, be a walk-on at Pitt. And he said he's practiced with a stripe ball, and that's where the sweet spot is. He goes to the college ball. You know, the stripes are missing on the side he wants to kick on because he want laces out, you know, Ray Finkel or Roy Finkel, whatever his name was in that movie. He said, and then you go to the NFL, there's no stripes. So you have to, but it's in that general area where the stripes are, but just not, doesn't have anything to do with the stripe, but I thought it was something.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, you know, people don't, you know, like old photographs of night football games, part of it's just, you know, the cameras weren't as good and the shutter speeds, you know, they weren't able to adjust some of that the way people can today. But, you know, like the early incandescent bulbs versus today's LEDs, the LEDs put out like, you know, 40 times more, you know, more light. So you can just imagine how dim the lighting was in some of those early attempts to play night football. So they needed a white ball and they needed stripes a whole lot more than we need them today.
Well, fascinating stuff as always. We thank you for sharing that history with us. And why don't you give out your website one more time and your social media. And you know, we thank you for that history.
Yeah. So footballarchaeology.com. And then, so just subscribe for free, see if you like it. And if you do, just keep, you'll get one every day. And then I'm also on Twitter, and I said FOFS earlier, but it's at FOF Strife. So that's my Twitter handle, but also, you know, search football archaeology and on Twitter and you'll find me right away.
Okay. And like we said, folks, if you're driving a car right now, listening to this podcast, you know, we thank you for that. You can, when you pull over and get some safety, check the show notes, and on pigskindispatch.com, we'll have Tim's information there as well to get you to him. Tim Brown, thank you once again, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Very good. Look forward to seeing you. Thanks.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history. through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.